Welcome to Moroccan American, a podcast about Morocco and the United States. These two countries have maintained a consistent and long-term friendship over centuries, even while their common interests have not always perfectly aligned. What started this relationship and what has sustained it? Diving into the fields of diplomacy, literature, trade, and art, in this podcast, we'll dissect different parts of the Moroccan American friendship and try to better understand this fascinating, complex, and close relationship. The first time I studied in Morocco as an undergraduate, I read parts of essays and book chapters by a couple of American anthropologists, Clifford Geertz and Paul Rabinow, that had done their field work in and around the Moroccan town of Sefrou in the 1960s and 70s. As I continued on into grad school, these works loomed larger, and I came to realize they were actually the tip of the iceberg in terms of American ethnographers working in Morocco. Hildred Geertz, Kevin and Daisy Dwyer, Dale Eichelman, Lawrence Rosen. I'm naturally going to leave out some names, but I always kind of wondered, why Morocco? How did Morocco become the focal point for all this field-changing ethnography coming out of the American Academy? I'm joined today by another anthropologist whose work on Morocco and North Africa I've long admired. Paul Silverstein is professor of anthropology at Reed College and the author of Algeria and France, Transpolitics, Race, Nation, out with IU Press, and Postcolonial France, Race, Islam, and the Future of the Republic, published by Pluto. He chairs the board of directors of MEREP, the Middle East Research and Information Project, and he co-edits the Public Cultures in the Middle East and North Africa book series with IU Press. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Paul, I want to start our conversation today by asking you about Morocco specifically, and kind of like a why Morocco question. Why do you think so many American anthropologists have conducted ethnographic research in Morocco?
Thanks, Graham. That's a great question. Thanks for having me on your podcast. I think there's two parts of this question. One, which is why Morocco, and what is the relationship between why Morocco for Americans and why Morocco for anthropologists? And those are kind of slightly two different questions, but they actually converge to answer your question. So maybe the first one is the bigger one, which is why Morocco for anthropologists? I mean, and this is to me an interesting question in general, because it goes back a long time. It goes back, in fact, to the entire history of anthropology. There's been a relationship with Morocco, in particular North Africa more broadly. And I mean, to some extent, you can trace the history of anthropology back to actually Ibn Khaldun. So we're talking like 14th century scholar.
All right.
I mean, we're far away from the U.S. right now, and you know, but in a sense, kind of creates the social sciences, and does it, you know, for you know, not solely academic reasons, but you know, but lays the groundwork for both a certain kind of approach to what is society and to a set of assumptions. Such as the notion of asabiyya, of a kind of tribal sense of collectivity,
right?
Which he attributes to Bedouin, which kind of eventually makes its way through various kind of translations and kind of reinterpretations into a basic category of the social sciences, which is that of mechanical solidarity. That's literally built which is tied to Emile Durkheim, who got it from Emile Mascaret, who got it from his translations and is reading the translations of Ibn Khaldun.
Okay.
So you can trace, like, in some sense, a key term in anthropology. I mean, the one that gives us a sense of what is it that makes a group that goes all the way back to Ibn Khaldun's work in studying North Africa. So if you start going from there, that leads, you know, and I mean, Durkheim's model of mechanical solidarity leads to kind of models of segmentation, and basically the birth of social anthropology through people who we generally don't associate with North Africa, like Evans Pritchard, famous British anthropologist, kind of created the notion of segmentary lineage model. We think of that for the newer, but he actually kind of refined it in working in the Cyrenaica. And then his kind of students, like Ernest Gellner, but also American anthropologists like David Hart, pick up on that model and bring it to study Morocco itself, whether in the High Atlas Mountains or in the southeast, or in the Rif Mountains in the north. So they're kind of basically still elaborating on this kind of basic kind of model that Ibn Khaldun lays down many years ago. and all that. And then you can continue to trace basically every, it's slightly a conceit. I do an entire course where I teach anthropological theory through ethnographies of Morocco. And you can teach just every single move from social, from structural functionalism, structural functionalism, to structuralism, to interpretive anthropology, to various kinds of postmodern and Foucauldian anthropologies through ethnographies of Morocco. So there's partly this is, kind of people following a line that, as they say, Ibn Khaldun laid down, partly it has to do with a particular history of Morocco, North Africa, to Europe, to the West,
right.
as the proximate other, as the kind of rival world-making power, if you will, or at least kind of as it's connected to the Ottoman Empire, which makes it, which makes it a problem for Europe, and also very close by, geographically, but also close by culturally, as kind of sharing some of the elements of kind of at least Southern European worlds. It's part of the Mediterranean, but also so different because of the influences of Islam and other, again, imperial projects.
So you're drawing a connection here between sort of a longer history of Morocco. I think I'm coming at this, and I asked you to talk thinking about, as a historian, the works of anthropology that I've read, which really kind of pick up in the 60s and 70s. But you're suggesting that there's actually a much longer history of ethnographers from the West going to Morocco to do this field work. And so people like Clifford and Hildred Geertz and Paul Rabinow are coming there and actually building on a tradition before that.
That's correct. Yeah, that's a great way to put it. There is a tradition that's laid down that goes back to the pre-colonial period of travelers, including some who are North African themselves, like Leo Africanus, who's kind of writing some of the first ethnographic reports, that get published in, originally in Latin and Italian and, translated across all the languages, to British travelers and French travelers who are there sometimes as captives during the long Barbary Wars of the 18th and 19th centuries, then kind of colonial ethnologists, once the problem of trade and maritime piracy is de facto solved by European colonial ventures, by the French conquest of Algeria, and then later establishment of protectorates across the region, both British and Italian and French as well. This kind of calls forth a certain kind of new ethnography, a new kind of anthropology, to simply describe and as a means to rule, and many of these ethnographers who are there at that time from the late part of the 19th century into the first half of the 20th century until independence are there as part of either the military or government projects. So there is a kind of long history, a long ethnographic history that creates archives after archive, to which people like Geertz, like Rabinow are building on, are reading, are the basis by which they come to North Africa in the first place. So in terms of, there's a deep, long history of that particular relationship, which is tied to, again, that proximity, but also that rivalry, which North Africa represents. So that's the story of kind of Morocco's relationship to anthropology. There's a slightly different story we'd have to then talk about America's relationship to Morocco, which is also a long history as well.
So, I guess that could be a good entry point into asking, like, why American anthropologists specifically, decide to kind of make this leap into Morocco. What draws them there? Do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, I think there are a couple things. One, which is, partly just the legacy within anthropology that the colonial archive kind of exists for them. Secondly, it has to. I think you can trace it to a couple of things. One, Morocco's long relationship, or America's long relationship with Morocco, that goes back to the end of, to the founding of the American Republic. Still to this day, America has had a diplomatic, mission there, a legation in, at least in Tangiers, going back to the end of the 18th century, which still exists and is still a research center for American anthropologists who passed there through there, right? It's where Paul Bowles, did his own kind of work as kind of representation and collecting and archiving and kind of recording of Moroccan culture.
Interesting, yeah.
So there's that long relationship, which Brian Edwards, for instance, is kind of just, traced in his book Morocco Bound, which captures that kind of double meaning of it, Morocco is a kind of site of destination, and all the kind of travels that bring people there all through from generations of travelers and tourists and the hippie trail and beyond. Yeah. But also Morocco Bound in the sense of publication, the sense of representation and textualization, that books being written are bound in Moroccan leather.
Right.
So there's this long history that of attention to Morocco that goes, and to North Africa in general, that, that's tied to the, in some ways, to the history of the United States, and which is kind of makes Morocco kind of, I think, present in the American conversation, in terms of representations of otherness and Orientalism. So there's that, and that's a long history. Again, that goes back several centuries. The more proximate history is that of World War II. And World War II is the first kind of moment, I think, where you get, a kind of strong American presence in Morocco in terms of a military presence, really, in terms of, military bases, in terms of really on-the-ground relations. Carlton Kuhn, who may be the first American anthropologist to kind of really write about Morocco, he's there in the 1920s doing dissertation research in the Reef. But really what he's known for is his time in Morocco and North Africa in general as an OSS officer.
Yeah.
And it's on the basis of that experience that he ends up, kind of writing. Now, Carlton Kuhn is known for kind of his theories of race and his kind of eugenics kind of notions. So we don't want to talk about Carlton Kuhn, but there's, in a sense, like that kind of, that kind of building of that kind of actual American presence there as this kind of, as a set of scholars, as Morocco, as a site for academic research, then kind of starts getting laid out.
Is part of this the way sort of academic inquiry is structured, where, you are kind of, the next generation of scholars is encouraged to sort of make an intervention into a field. There's an existing body of knowledge. You're seeking to revise it or figure out what's wrong with it, or, what we don't yet know. And because there's a tradition, and as a historian, I've spent a lot of time with these colonial ethnographies. And I mean, it is really remarkable how many there are and for how many specific, quite small or undensely populated places in Morocco. So you've got, people are always kind of coming into this with a lot of written tradition, written information in the, archive, formal or otherwise. And so generations of academics are kind of building, on this.
I think that's part of the story. I think there's also another part of the story, which is that Morocco is relatively welcoming, certainly compared to other places in North Africa, is certainly post-independence. So, Algeria, Tunisia quickly transitioned to authoritarian states. They are not interested in foreign researchers spending a lot of time there. They're not interested in people kind of running around in rural areas. They're not interested in that. Whereas Morocco, it's relatively more open. Partly, again, it's the relationship that Morocco has forged with the United States, which is different from that of, what Algeria is doing in its kind of more non-aligned kind of fashion, kind of trying to separate itself from the Cold War politics, has a stronger sense of decolonization than Morocco does, which considered itself to always be independent, or at least semi-independent. So there's partly that story. Part of that is, relatedly, is the Peace Corps. The story of the Peace Corps, I think, is a key piece to understanding why so many anthropologists end up in Morocco. It's not simply because there's a body of knowledge that you're going to build on, and maybe you're being trained by somebody else who worked in Morocco, and they're encouraging you to follow their path. There's also the fact that many, many anthropologists and other scholars who end up working in Morocco started off there as Peace Corps volunteers. It's one of the largest missions that the Peace Corps has in the world.
Yeah, that's a great one.
And they're located in rural areas, and they're trained in local languages. So they come out of the Peace Corps with a relationship to a place, with some kind of level of competence in either Derija or in one of the Amazir languages. And that's a really, in anthropology, you spend a lot of time doing language learning. So it's the condition of possibility for the research you're going to do on the ground. And so that's kind of when people then, if that already kind of makes them interested in those parts of the world, or in kind of the thought of kind of working about kind of human worlds, kind of different ways of living otherwise. And they end up going into this academically. That's kind of what they're, that's the, that is the capital they're carrying with them.
So you brought up something, and I plan to get to this later, but maybe now is a good time. Something that comes up in Rabinow's work and in a lot of responses and building on that is this idea of radical otherness. That people are, that our anthropologists are seeking, or sometimes are really just wondering about the kind of possibility of this thing. I mean, you know, I'm from Lexington, Kentucky, born and raised. I don't know where you grew up, but certainly, you know, it's hard for me to deny the kind of interest in Morocco and in Moroccan society, in part because of this sense of that it is, that there is an otherness. There's something that I really don't understand. And, you know, each time I spend time there, and I don't know about you as an anthropologist, but there's another like kind of layer that you're peeling back, recognizing that, you know, you're never going to like fully thickly describe the thing that you want to do, but you're sort of seeking that. I mean, is that something that drew you to Morocco? I don't know if that's a good way to phrase the question.
I think that's right. I think part of that, what you're talking about, is what draws many people to Morocco. I mean, it's part of the story of the hippie trail. It's part of the story of finding that otherness, seeing something that's close. Again, you don't have to go that far. You get there very quickly. As easy as it is to get to Europe, you just hop a ferry to, you're in Tangier. And you leave Tangier and suddenly you're in the Rif Mountains and like you're in a different world and it feels like a different world. And this kind of the metaphor of layers has been used many times, in part to think about what, you know, try to tease out what is the society. I think Clifford Geertz talked about as a composite society, as a society that has these different layers to it. That layer, you know, a kind of Amazigh culture layered on top of, with an Arab culture, which is layered on in, you know, an Islam, which is layered on top with a long kind of history of French presence and kind of urban worlds next to rural worlds, Amazigh speaking next to Arabic speaking, and the way Jewish and Christian, you know, Jewish and Muslim, all kind of in some ways kind of connected, including, you know, kind of long histories of kind of connections and relations and migrations across the, you know, to sub-Saharan Africa. I mean, these are like, as you get deeper into it, you realize they're all there. In fact, this is why simplistic models like that are imported into it, or that are developed but then re-imported, such as, you know, the work of Ernest Gellner, to a lesser extent David Hart, you know, on these segmentary models, comes off as somewhat overly simplistic for those who actually spend time there, which then kind of, you know, entice someone like Geertz, you know, and his students, like, you know, their Lawrence Rosen or Paul Rabinow. When they get there, they realize like these simplistic models just simply don't work, you know, that what we need to kind of, we need to have a different way of thinking about it. For Geertz and Rosen, it was transactional. It was that Morocco, like, eventually there's so many different layers that everybody, you know, kind of as a kind of individual, or, you know, as a person, has to kind of navigate these, whether you're Moroccan or not. And you do it by creating these kinds of, these forms of relationality that you're constantly navigating and negotiating across these different boundaries that everybody is crossing. So partly it is that kind of multiplicity and proximity of Morocco that makes it so enticing, if you will. Yeah.
You know, can I ask then about your field work? Like, tell me how you got started. Were you, I know Morocco is not your first kind of area of expertise, but what drew you to Morocco to start working there?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I mean, for a long time, I'd avoided Morocco. Simply, I literally thought like, this is the kind of place that you're going to go to and you're going to get very attracted to, and you're going to spend your rest of your life trying to figure it out. And I had other plans, right? I had other things I wanted to think about. I had broader ambitions, perhaps. And I'd read too much, you know, about the history of anthropology and the history of, you know, of scholarship in the region, that as people have narrated, like, tended to head towards these kind of peripheral locations that kind of were very, fit with, you know, kind of Orientalist models, exotic kind of places, you know, and that you know, Morocco in the West and Yemen in the East. And it's true that there's a disproportionate amount of scholarship, especially anthropological scholarship, since the Second World War, really, but since the 50s and 60s, that, like, focused either on Yemen or on Morocco. I mean, these were places where people were interested in tribal cultures ended up going, right? In part because, again, they were open to researchers, in part because they were, you know, less urbanized, perhaps, or less, you know, kind of modernized in the way in which, you know, kind of we tend to generally think of this, and therefore appealed, I think, if you're looking for an alternative, if you're looking for a way out of, you know, Euro-modernity, where are you going to go? So I wanted to avoid it for precisely that reason.
Right.
And I was more interested in the history of, in the history and kind of present kind of worlds that were in Algeria and in the Algerian diaspora. And so most of my original work was in, was working in France, actually in Paris, in the suburbs of Paris with the people of mostly Algerian, but also more broadly North African descent. I felt like that was, it had its own limits, both anthropologically, personally, in terms of the development of my own ideas. I thought it had to be balanced by work that was, I would do, you know, on the other, you know, in, if I was really going to do a transnational anthropology, it had to be multi-sided. It also kind of had to kind of work back and forth from North Africa as well. And I kept, you know, the goal was to go to Algeria, and the war in Algeria just kept going and going. I'm talking about the insurgency and counterinsurgency warfare, the black decade of the 90s, which really lasted into the early 2000s, at least for the Berbers, you know, the Amazigh speaking areas of Kabylia. And it was just, doing research there was difficult. Getting a visa was almost impossible. A research visa, like extremely difficult. So, yeah. So I ended up, you know, I was like, okay, I need to spend some time in North Africa. Well, I can just go to Morocco. So, you know, and I can, I'll just go and like spend some time in Rabat and maybe travel around and kind of get a sense of the kind of Amazigh activism that I was beginning to be interested in, at least in the diaspora. Let's see how that plays out here.
Yeah.
And I go to Rabat, where, and I start kind of making connections in different Amazigh associations, movements. This is, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s. So this is before, Amazigh is being nationally recognized or part of the constitution as it's become. Now you go, it's a different world. But at the time I was going there, it was, people were being arrested for publicly, you know, for publicly advocating for the Amazigh language and culture, mm-hmm. you know, for holding up signs written in the Amazigh, they would end up in jail. They would be tortured. They would be in, you know, you know, it was bad. Now, you know, the irony is, as you know, when you go to Morocco since 2012, you know, you can go to you know the ministries of and the intelligence services, the ones who are arresting the people, now have their buildings written with Amazigh, you know, with Amazigh language on it. There's something deeply ironic. I mean, has anything really changed? Unclear. There's still great inequality, there's still great difference. In any case, I end up in Rabat. I'm just presenting some of my past research and kind of my interests in various Amazigh associations, talking to Amazigh people. And I meet some guy, and he's like, oh, well, given your history and given the kind of research and the, your interest in Algeria, you should come to where I'm from. And where he was from was this small town called Boulmima in the southeast part of the country, which ends up being a kind of super important in the history of Amazigh activism, which oddly has a disproportionate, for its size, kind of impact in terms of numbers of militants who end up from this area, who end up, you know, doing work on the national and international stage. And so that's what attracted me ultimately. I said, okay, why this small town? Why this valley and not the valley next to it, not the valley on the other side? Why did this area, what is it about this place that generated such kind of active and intense activism around the Amazigh language and culture? When 50%, you know, 60% of the country is, you know, Amazigh speaking, you know, at least, you know, in terms of native language.
Right. You know, I want to ask you now, like, how Morocco shaped your work. And it made me, what you just said made me think about, you know, working on Amazigh movements in France and with Algeria, but now you're in a specific part of Morocco. Like, how are you thinking about the bigger kind of transnational, you know, as you said, transnational ethnographic you know, questions that you've always been interested in because of your experience in Morocco?
Well, certainly in terms of the specifics of what I was, of the work I've been doing with Amazigh, the Amazigh cultural movement, it changes it altogether. And I think there's a kind of dimension, if you only see the big picture, if you only see, okay, what's happening at the national level, the demonstrations, the marches, the protests, the claims, the calls, the advocacy, and, you know, as part of broader indigenous movements that happen at the UN and beyond, you're only getting part of the picture. I mean, as you get, the more local you get, the more you realize that these are embedded in various kinds of local tensions, rivalries, ambivalences, kind of material concerns. And so the first thing that, like, I realized as I grounded this, instead of thinking about it as, again, within this kind of broader transnational frame, as I started thinking in a kind of very local frame, I realized that what was at stake, and people, you know, in ways that people kind of realized, was all these symbolic gestures for language and culture were really standing in for a set of very kind of material concerns about how do you reproduce the kind of world in the present, these rural worlds that like, from people's point of view, were literally dying.
Yeah.
Dying because of emigration, dying because of land expropriation, dying because of urban trends that were, you know, being forced upon them, dying because of kind of national surveillance and like the imposition of kind of, you know, Arabic language and culture through the school system.
Yeah.
This was seen as a, you know, this was understood to be a loss, and it was a material loss, literally, you know, in terms of ways of life, forms of habitation, forms of agriculture that were becoming no longer remunerable, that were becoming no longer possible. And people had to, you know, were having to remake their lives in ways that were, you know, that meant that they couldn't, you know, live the lives of their parents or their grandparents. And yeah, so this was, so partly was for me to, it allowed the kind of research I did in Morocco, in a kind of in a rural area in Morocco, in a small, you know, a village system, was to kind of realize that, you know, behind these larger kind of symbolic fights, which are, you know, were meaningful in and of themselves, lie some real material concerns that one had to take into account. So that's part of the, I mean, that's a kind of particular lesson I was given.
Yeah. So these, the questions about, you know, culture and language are actually, like, I mean, you know, maybe, I mean, symbolic of things themselves, but also just like directly, you know, connected to all the issues of daily life and sustenance, right, and social reproduction. And
exactly. And those, and once you get down to that level, you realize how deeply, how complicated it is, right? Because there's not just like, you know, I mean, there isn't just the Amazir subject, right? There's not just somebody who's like, every single person is embedded in a particular family, in a particular lineage, in a particular kind of household, in a particular kind of village and sub-village, you know, in a kind of set of heterogeneous world, right? You know, which layers on top of it other people who might equally identify as Amazir, but who have a kind of different kind of relationship to it because their material circumstances are very, really quite different.
Yeah.
You realize quickly that those who have kind of been able to put themselves forward as activists tend to be people with pretty high levels of education. Mm-hmm. How do they get those levels of education? Well, they had to come from a certain kind of privilege to end up in those schools, to end up with the, you know, the kind of, you know, both the economic capital, but the cultural capital to be able to study. They came from these kind of notable families.
Yeah.
And these notable families have been notable families for generations. And their notability, their capacity to accumulate economic and social and cultural capital has been at the expense of others who, you know, they were able to extract that from.
Yeah.
And those folks who also speak the Amazir languages, who also like kind of live in Amazir worlds, kind of tend to be excluded from those kinds of those educational possibilities, and therefore those active, you know, from the,
yeah,
activist possibilities and associations. So who, it starts raising questions like, who do activists speak for?
Mm-hmm.
Like, and, you know, and who gets to speak and who doesn't get to speak? You know? So that's the other level of things that I've come to realize and get embedded with. And there are dimensions of that that are purely material. They're racialized. They play off in whiteness and blackness and, like, you know, anti-blackness, and beyond. So it led me to open up other questions that my earlier research hadn't been, because in part it was responding to the situation of being of racialized themselves, and all of them as kind of foreigners and North Africans in France.
Yeah.
But once you get to North Africa, once you get down to the local level, you realize there's another layer of complexity underneath it that, you know, then reciprocally plays itself out in the diaspora in ways I didn't even see it at first, you know, but now I see it.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah, that's really interesting. Let's go back to the work of Geertz and Rabinow, Rosen. We could talk about others, Gellner, who, you know, are kind of, seem like they're sort of part of this wave of anthropology and in the mid 20th century that kicks off a new interest in Morocco, at least from an ethnographic standpoint. You know, are they dated? How do they seem to you now? I mean, I'm sure decades after, you know, you first encountered them.
I mean, of course they're, yeah. I mean, we're now, you know, 60 years later from 56 years later from some of the original research they did, going back to the, you know, late 50s into the 60s, into the early 70s. They're dated by the fact that they're older, but, you know, every time I pick up a work of Geertz, I'm inspired. And that's not just me. That's generations, including generations of Moroccan anthropologists, you know, someone like Abdullah Hamoudi, who I think is, you know, one of the most brilliant minds and the person who first trained me, to be honest, the first taught me French social theory, from reading with him Bourdieu and Merleau-Ponty, you know, into Lévi-Strauss and into Foucault and others. You know, I mean, if you, you know, you talk to Hamoudi, you know, who's kind of built a kind of Moroccan anthropology, it's very Geertzian. I mean, he sees, like, for all that, you know, Geertz was limited, perhaps, you know, just because of where he worked and, you know, and how we tend to think, there's something to be found there. Rabinow, of course, you know, broke with Geertz and kind of took this direction towards, you know, much more kind of practice theory or Foucauldian theory later on, and thought that Geertz was engaged in something that was kind of too much of a kind of bounded notion of culture, too much kind of tied to a certain kind of exoticism, too much unquestioning about what the subject is. I mean, I think this is an unfair critique. I think most of us think it's an unfair critique. I don't think Rabinow came off well in this.
Yeah.
And if you're going to, you know, if you just put those side by side, Geertz's legacy is going to live much longer. I mean, Geertz is going to be taught and, you know, is taught and still going to be taught, not just in anthropology, but across, like, all the hermeneutic disciplines, you know, in the humanities in general.
Yeah.
Whereas you're not going to read Rabinow, to be honest. You know, maybe you read Reflections on Fieldwork in Morocco to make, you know, and kind of laugh about it. You know, it becomes like, oh, here's what you shouldn't do when you do fieldwork. I mean, I think that's how people tend to read it now, unfortunately. I mean, I don't think that's quite fair. I think there's insights in all of this stuff. I tend to be much more generous, but it's, you know, in a sense, the Geertz, and it's not, you know, Geertz and Rosen and Eichelman and others of that generation who created this kind of a particular new approach, a very American approach, a very transactional notion of culture, a very hermeneutic notion of culture. That was a condition of possibility for then the next generation, if you will, who did the more kind of postmodern approaches. I'm thinking like the work of Vincent Crapanzano or Kevin Dwyer and others who really developed what we now call postmodern anthropology, Rabinow too, in that. And I don't think that per se is going to have the same legs. I don't think, you know, I think people are realize that that move, that anti-empiricist move that was built into that kind of model, kind of misses out on the ultimate duty and project of anthropology, which is to describe the ways in which people live and try to live and try to kind of make do often with, you know, under the constraints in which they live in, and the responsibility that anthropology has to kind of be in a platform for those voices when those voices are not heard.
Otherwise. Yeah.
So I think there, yeah. So my sense is that, you know, I mean, I'm sorry if I'm being a little abstract here, but, you know,
no. I posed the question. I mean, rereading Geertz, and it strikes me as Geertz is sort of the one that has filtered into history the most. And Eichelman too recently. Mm-hmm. I was struck that there was like a humility there. There was a sense of like that this idea of a thick description allows you to like try to figure something out, acknowledging that you might not really ever fully grasp, you know, how people other than you who come from a different, you know, social cultural background than you think, but that, you know, if you work at it, you can get closer to it. I mean, that's extremely positivist, I guess, but it does seem like that's, you know, it just has a lasting
Yeah, I mean,
impact.
I mean, I mean, if you think of culture, I mean, Geert said, look, we need to think about culture as an artistic text, a text that people are writing and continually writing and interpreting themselves. And anthropologists, you know, read it and interpret it over the shoulder of those who are themselves of that culture, reading and interpreting.
Right.
And our goal is to like give us a sense, a little bit of a sense of how they go about reading and interpreting that which they are themselves, in a sense, part, you know, authors of. Uh-huh. And it's true. That's a deep humility to it. We're not trying to describe like what is the human subject at that point, you know, like in the way I think that, you know, if you follow the, or you know, to describe, you know, these kind of leviathans of power, which is, I think, a move that, you know, someone like Rabinow was trying to make. I think there's something more. Yeah, there's something very, you know, humble about it as well. Yeah.
Do you have a sense of the impact that American anthropology has had on the Moroccan Academy? You mentioned Abdullah Hammoudi, you know, sort of growing up with some of these works. Is that, I mean, could you speak more to how it's shaped a Moroccan field or Moroccan discipline?
Yeah, I mean, I can try. I mean, there are clearly a number of Moroccans who worked closely with American anthropologists and you know, quasi anthropologists, you know, and who in a sense, like in those encounters, in those dialogues themselves, changed their lives and changed their worlds. And some of whom went on to become anthropologists themselves. And that goes back a while. Is also the case you have, you know, centers of American learning in Morocco, places like Al-Ghouain University, which has trained, if you will, a generation of Moroccans in fields, you know, of cultural studies and anthropology and history and the social sciences, you know, and American things, some of whom have gone on to graduate school in the United States and have gone on to get PhDs in anthropology and represent a younger generation, whether they're now based in the United States or in Morocco. You now have people who are trained, often the older generation, like Hammoudi or Hassan Ashik and others were trained by someone like Paul Pascon, who is a French rural sociologist, basically an anthropologist doing these kind of teamwork projects of documentation, but also kind of understanding kind of rural lives in Morocco, who they went on in some cases to kind of, I mean, Hammoudi was, you know, end up in the United States at Princeton, but the others ended up in Morocco and have trained Moroccans in the field of anthropology in Morocco, in Moroccan universities. So there is a generation of folk who have read, who are familiar with the American field, who are doing great work, you know, and, you know, just, you know, people come to mind of the younger generation who are now big, you know, who are becoming big figures and, you know, in the field of anthropology, someone like Omar Boum, you know, out of UCLA, who's done incredible work and continues to do so in really unexpected ways. Or, you know, to a lesser extent, Hussein Elahian, based in Kentucky, or Abdelmajid Hanoum, who's based in Kansas. I mean, so you have like these Moroccan anthropologists of a certain generation who are the younger generation who are kind of following the steps. But there is, I mean, it's a field now. It's a field in Morocco in ways that I think you'd have to recognize, even if the social sciences in Morocco have never, you know, for years have been underfunded and not received the same monies that, you know, the STEM fields or Islamic studies, for instance, has.
You know, we've mainly talked about men, male ethnographers in the field. But there is a, you know, there's a pretty long tradition of women anthropologists as well doing ethnography in Morocco. I mean, do you think, one, like Morocco has been conducive to that and asking, you know, both to women anthropologists, but to asking gender questions through ethnography, you know what I mean? And then two, you know, is that something maybe we see in other places as well? Is this something that's unique to Morocco?
Yeah, I mean, like much of anthropology, especially anthropology in the Middle East, North Africa, but elsewhere as well, you know, it tended to be, you know, white European and American men who were coming either through military auspices. I mean, they were literally military men in the colonial period, or and as soldiers like Carlton Coon or intelligence officers, or an Evans Pritchard, you know, in the previous generation, and like, you know, Jacques Vielk and Robin Montagnier and the whole generation of, of French pitchers in Morocco. Or they were, you know, the kind of hip, you know, they're on the hippie trail in some way or into the other, as Brian Edwards put it. They were kind of attracted to the otherness because they were trying to, they were looking for an out from the US. And there's certainly plenty of women on the hippie trail, but it was kind of like a white dude kind of centric place. And it was kind of, you know, a different kind of a different performance of masculinity for sure. And that partially explains, I don't think it fully explains Geertz, but you know, him, Geertz and him, himself, but it certainly may explain Rabinow. So at least Rabinow, I think, would present himself in some ways like that and others of that generation. Who went in the '60s. But remember, Geertz went with Hildred, and Hildred Geertz is a powerhouse of an anthropologist, you know, and that I don't think people quite recognize, you know, in part because, you know, the ways in which women's concerns were always secondary because they tended to kind of focus on, you know, on lives of households, kind of the private lives rather than public lives, things that were less kind of present, like ritual, and more kind of domestic rituals rather than public rituals. You know?
So, yeah, sure.
But Hildred was there, and you know, similarly, and you know, B.J. Furnia was there with, you know, with Bob Furnia when they were doing their research in Morocco. Again, you know, about, you know, 10 years later. So these are often, so in these cases, we're talking about trailing spouses, but those aren't the only, you know, but alongside that there's been, and, or Daisy Dwyer alongside Kevin Dwyer, who were all doing amazing. I mean, they were like really, to a certain extent, like as good, if not better anthropologists than their husbands, but their husbands because of the patriarchy built into the academy, you know, they had the positions, they had the, you know, they had the readerships, they had the things, and so there's been a kind of, I think there's been a deep ignoring of the work that women anthropologists have been doing there, you know, in Morocco and in North Africa and in really, you know, across the world for a long time, in part because of that kind of male domination scene. And I think that's especially true in the Middle East and North Africa, just because of the kind of notion of public male sociality, and the attraction, you know, everybody's like, you know, everybody's a little Lawrence of Arabia. You know, all these men, you know, watch these things and be like, oh, I'm going to be there and I'm going to go hang out with these Arab men and we're going to like, you know, shoot guns and we're going to like have this kind of intense kind of male intimacy without like, you know, feeling kind of weird about it. And it allows that. I think there's something attractive about that. And then you end up kind of, that pulls you into stories and into kind of public affairs and into rivalries and it leads you to see the world through segmentary lineage theory and conflict and like, you know, feuds and things like that. And that's very attractive, I think, to a certain kind of readership. All I'm doing right now is explaining why women anthropologists have been part of the story of Morocco, at least American anthropology in Morocco since the 60s, like haven't been as recognized. That's of course changes with the younger generation as we become deeply self-critical of both the patriarchy and the Orientalism built within it. And you know, and women are there, you know, women anthropologists are as present, I think, as read now, you know, as men, male anthropologists, at least in the younger generation.
One thing that maybe we touched on a little bit, but maybe we could be more specific about is, like, are there specific things, you know, about Morocco, about, you know, the way research, the way, you know, the, are there specific things about Moroccan society or Moroccan politics that make it a conducive place to conduct research, whether that's from a very practical standpoint or just a, you know, a real kind of research question, methodological standpoint.
Yeah. I mean, I think we touched on it. It's one, it's the, like, you know, in terms of the logistics, it's so easy. I mean, both proximity, both in terms of getting there, getting around, in terms of research permits, you know, which, or just, you know, being allowed to do the research, simply being allowed to do that and not having to jump through as many bureaucratic hoops as you do in many, many places. Makes it makes that attractive in and of itself. But secondly, I think you said these kind of this layered density of culture and society and politics that exists in Morocco. That's, you know, incredibly diverse as you move north to south, as you move east to west, as you move from coastal areas to the inland areas, as you move from the fertile plains to the mountains to the desert area. I mean, it's like a lot of culture, a lot of diversity within a kind of you know, single place, is you move across linguistic boundaries and racialized boundaries and, you know, things that are considered to be ethnicity and kind of religious. And like, you know, I mean, all of that is there and it leaves traces and layers on top of each other.
Thanks for listening to Moroccan American. This podcast was recorded and produced by Graham Cornwell, that's me, and Amanda Brockler. The podcast intro and outro music is Coast Highway by AA Alto. Moroccan American is part of the Moroccan American Studies Initiative. Thanks to the Institute for Middle East Studies at the George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs. And finally, a big thank you to the Tangier American Legation, Institute for Moroccan Studies, and the U.S. Embassy at Rabat, whose support makes this project possible. Of course, the words and ideas expressed in this podcast series do not represent either of our sponsors.